Let's give our honored guest here a big welcome, Charles Chuck Isaacson.
Thank you, sir.
Yes.
It's good to see all you ladies and gentlemen. And I'm here to bring you greetings from the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association of South Dakota. Now, we're not a very big group, but I think we make up in quality what we might lack in quantity. I think the reason they got me is because I'm the only one here in hearing. And the closest ones, we got a fellow up in Aberdeen, Huabe, Colton, about three in Sioux Falls, one in Vermilion, and I got a few out in the Black Hills, out in the Rapid City area. But we're few and far between. And I like it that way because we get to know each other a lot better. The only thing about the Pearl Harbor survivors is that they're like the, after World War I, they had the last man, you know. And the last man, well, they weren't always the last man, but they finally dropped out of the picture until there was only one left. And about that time, they opened up a bottle of champagne, if the guy could still, was still young enough to drink it, and he was the last man. Well, I don't know whether they still got a bottle of champagne down here in our group or not, unless somebody's been nipping at it all these years. And but anyway, that's the least of my worries. This is a national organization, nationwide. We have a national headquarters. But here in South Dakota, we have only, I can count them on two hands, the number of people we have at our convention. We have two conventions a year, one in the spring and one in the fall. In fact, we had one here in Huron last spring. And counting all the wives and the guests and everybody else, I don't think there were over 25 people there. But that's the way it is. You see, an organization like ours does not increase in numbers, it decreases. People pass, get out of the picture along the way. I went to Hawaii in 1940. I was in the infantry. And I went there on a two-year period, a two-year tour of duty. And that's all I was supposed to be, 2 years. So I was there for about, a year and a third, and then something happened. Pearl Harbor. I got up that Sunday morning. Ordinarily, I probably wouldn't have been up that early. But I was supposed to go down to our regiment and build a boxing ring. Now at that time, Pearl Harbor, or Schofield Barracks, where I was stationed, was the largest army post in the world. We had four full regular infantry regiments, plus all the artillery, the engineers, and what have you that went with it. And Schofield Barracks is about 15 miles out of Pearl Harbor. It's in the central part of the island. I'm talking about the island of Oahu, O-A-H-U. It's not the largest island in the group. I think it's about the third. The largest island is the island of Hawaii. And the second largest is either one of the other two. But Pearl Harbor and Oahu is the most important part of the Hawaiian Islands. It's Honolulu, Waikiki Beach, Schofield Barracks, where I was stationed. And all the places that you read about and hear about. Now, how do you get to be a Pearl Harbor survivor? Well, it's not very difficult, really. All you have to do is to serve in the military on the island of Oahu on December 7th, 1941. Now, if you left the island a day early, you don't qualify. If you get back there a day late, you don't qualify. You have to have been in the service on the island of Oahu on December 7th, or within 3 miles of the coast. So in a way, it's a kind of an exclusive group, but it gets less exclusive every year, because you don't get new recruits. You never add on to it. You just subtract off from it. Now, I remember December 6th very well. I remember I had to get home early because I had a job to do. I was supposed to build a boxing ring in the regimental quadrangle. Now, a regimental quadrangle had four regiments. Each one of them was in a square with three battalions plus a headquarters. And I was supposed to build a boxing ring in the middle of this quadrangle. So I got up early, earlier than I normally would have on a Sunday morning. And I started down to where I ate breakfast in my 37 Ford, which used more oil than gas, incidentally. And as I was going down the way, I heard these machine guns firing and heard this explosion. And I thought, well, what the heck is going on here? And I thought it must be some kind of a new type of maneuver, an air maneuver that they were having. So I forgot about breakfast, and I turned around, and I went down toward Wheeler Field. Now, Wheeler Field sits right adjoining Schofield Barracks, and it was at that time the largest fighter plane base on the islands. They had P-40 airplanes. They just gotten them about a year before. And so I went down to where I could look down on Wheeler Field, and I was amazed. I saw the Jap planes diving down, firing, dropping bombs, all hell going around. And I stopped the car. I was in shock, actually. And I'll never forget. In fact, the day of Pearl Harbor, I never will forget. I can remember things that I can't remember 2 days ago. And this guy was lying down beside a house. And I'd stopped the car, of course, and I saw all these planes bombing and firing machine guns. And I'll never forget what he said. He said, "You better get the hell out of here. This is the real McCoy. Those are the Japs." So I took his advice and I got the hell out of there. First thing I did is I went back to my quarters, and I picked up a 45 automatic pistol, which I'd been on guard duty. Now, I don't know why I picked up that 45 automatic pistol, because that was good for nothing. I wouldn't even been any good at throwing it at somebody. That was the most inaccurate weapon that was ever invented, unless you were, right up close. And then I wouldn't be too sure about it. But so then I went back to my unit, and there was, as you can imagine, real confusion. Nobody knew what was going on. Nobody knew what had happened. Nobody knew what to do. The first thing they had to do was to pass out the rifles. The men didn't carry the rifles around with them. They had them in racks in their squad rooms. And then they had to issue ammunition, because they didn't carry ammunition with them either. Because ammunition in that climate corroded so fast. And then they loaded the machine gun belts. Now, in those days, when you loaded a machine gun belt, it came you had a web belt, and you had a machine, and you put the rounds in this machine and turned it around, and it pushed the rounds into the belt. And that's what you fired for machine guns. Now, it wasn't the most practical, because you had a lot of bad rounds, a lot of misfires, but it was the best we had. And so we issued the rifles, we issued the ammunition, and we're ready for what? I don't know. Neither did we know what we were ready for. We didn't know what to expect. That sounds kind of dumb, but it's a fact. We got caught with our pants down. We really did. We got caught by surprise, the biggest surprise that you can imagine. And how it happened, I can't tell you that. And I don't know who can. How they could come thousands of miles with their carriers up to within striking distance of Hawaii and attack in a complete surprise, I never could figure that out. Now, there have been a lot of books written about, the untold story about Pearl Harbor, the real truth about Pearl Harbor and all that, but who knows? Now, the ones that they put the blame on were General Short and Admiral Kimmel, who were the head Army man and the head Navy man in Hawaii. So they took a lot of heat, and they deserved it. After all, they were in charge, they were responsible, and they should have taken necessary precautions, whatever they were. But everybody was so complacent, they thought, well, it can't happen to us. It can't happen here. But it did happen. And it was a dreadful thing. Now, there were a lot of people killed, particularly in Pearl Harbor. There were a lot of Navy men killed. They were killed in the Arizona, the ship that they sank, and they left sunk as a monument. A lot of people died in that ship. And that's what they were after. They were after the battleships, because we had about 9 battleships in Pearl Harbor at that time. And they were after them because it would cripple our whole fleet. And they were also after the airfields, because if they got the airfields, kept the planes down, then the planes could not come up and fight the Japs. It was well organized, well planned, well carried out. And a lot of people were killed. And most of those that were killed were in Pearl Harbor, because that was the main target was the battleships and the cruisers. At Wheeler Field, which I said was just right next to Schofield Barracks, they wiped the planes out. You see, these planes were sitting there like ducks on a pond. They couldn't miss them. They had no protection. Same way with the planes down at Hickam Field near Pearl Harbor. And that was part of the plan, was to keep the planes down so they couldn't get back up after the Jap planes. Now, there were rumors galore. In Hawaii, they raise sugar cane and pineapples. And there was a rumor that the Japs had cut, that is the local Japs, had cut arrows in the sugar cane pointing at Pearl Harbor to help direct the planes there. There was a rumor that in the town of Waiawa, which is just outside of Schofield Barracks, that the streets were running with blood. The Filipinos were killing the Japs. Nothing to that. Nothing to the story about the arrows. There were rumors that people were downtown Honolulu were jumping out of milk trucks and shooting with machine guns. Nothing to that. I had a fellow tell me that should have known better, that there were 50 Jap transports offshore. Now, you can imagine what impact that would have if there were 50 Jap transports. I don't know how they got there or how they'd have that many there. But he was serious. He said there were 50 Jap transports offshore. So the next thing he expected was these transports would unload their troops and attack the island. I was going out to get some ammunition that night at the ammo dump, and it was dark. And a sentry stopped me, and he said, "Some Jap paratroops landed here on the golf course." He said, "We got some of them, but there's still some of them around." Well, I expected one of them to stick a bayonet in my face at any minute. But of course, there was nothing to it. And later on that night, the skies were just the greatest fireworks display you ever saw. Tracer bullets firing in the sky. I don't know what they were shooting at, but I don't think it was the Japs. So, it was a hectic time, and a lot of people got hurt, a lot of people got killed. Now, I said I was a Pearl Harbor survivor. That doesn't mean that I'm a hero by any means, or that most of them were heroes. But there were a lot of heroes. There were a lot of heroes in particularly in Pearl Harbor. A lot of them that died. Well, things calmed down, but not right away. You see, they'd been hurt. They'd been hurt once. They didn't want to get hurt again. So they were extra careful. We wore gas masks and had blackouts for a long time afterwards. We had alerts, submarine alerts. Actually, what I understood afterwards, that most of those submarine alerts were whales cavorting out in the ocean. And I think that was right. So we took extra precautions. We're out in the field most of the time. And nothing tragic happened. Like I said, you know, you get burned once, you don't want to get burned again right away. And so they took extra precautions. We're out in the field. You know, when you defend an island like the island of Oahu, Oahu is only about 20 miles this way and 20 miles that way. You can drive around it easy in one day and sightsee along the way. But you do not string all your troops in one big circle around the island. That'd be foolish, because it's like you play ring around the rosy, you know. If they strike at one place real hard, they can break through. So what you do is you have strong points out there with machine guns to alert you if an attack is coming. Of course, an attack never did come. But then you have your concentration of troops back in the high ground, and you move them wherever you have to get the threat, whatever it might be. Well, this went on for quite a while. Our troops finally moved out. We moved our regiment out. We moved to Australia. We went from Australia up to New Guinea. We went from New Guinea into the Philippines. And that's when I came home, a survivor, a Pearl Harbor survivor.